Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second. The following program is a PodcastOne.com production. He started in a small town in Texas. Worked his ass off to become one of the most famous wrestlers of all time.
We're going to take care of business tonight, and that's the bottom line.
And now, he's dominating the world of on-demand audio. And he's doing it for the working man.
This is a damn good outlet for me to spew the bullshit off my brain. Yeah!
This is the Steve Austin Show. Unleashed.
All right, everybody, welcome to Steve Austin Show. I am coming to you from the main streets of Los Angeles, California today. I got a hell of a show for you. I'm talking to my old pal, Paul Lazenby from Vancouver, B.C. If you remember, Paul is my stunt double back from the low-budget movie days back in the day. He's got a new book out. It's called When We Were Bouncers 2. I wrote the foreword for it. And I remember When We Were Bouncers 1. It was an outstanding book. This is exactly in the same vein. Quick read, good stories, lots of zingers. Everybody loves a good bouncer story, especially me. And it was good to be a part of this book, and I'm real happy for Paul. I think he's going to work on number 3. You'll hear that in the podcast. But he's going to tell us about some of the people and the stories in this new book. We're going to go back and talk about some of my low-budget movies that Paul and I filmed together, some of the shenanigans, bullshit, shortcuts that were taken during the film of these movies. Some of this shit, man, me and Paul are just laughing our asses off because we went through this stuff together. Paul's a good friend, and I hooked up with him because he was out here in Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago for that New Japan G1 tournament in Long Beach, and we're going to break down some of the matches, some of the performers from that event. You've heard me talk about some of them in the past, but it's a little bit different with Paul. Paul's opinions on some of the guys, including Kenny Omega. Paul just finished filming the new Predator movie. He's going to tell us a little bit about that, what he can talk about anyway. And there's a lot of bullshit to just cover with Paul, and some of the stories are pretty goddamn good. Wade Keller is going to be at the back end of the show to talk about this week's Raw and SmackDown as far as what's happening, a couple of storylines, a couple of the big angles they shot. The Kurt Angle storyline was a real doozy. I believe both him and I really enjoyed Fandango and Tyler Breeze's segment when they pulled the horse head out of the box, referencing the old Godfather movies. God damn, I laughed my ass off. Had to hit the rewind button. So we'll talk about a few things. I'm going to put my segments with Wade on hold for a little bit while I'm in production. It is very hard for me to do much of anything once Broken Skull Challenge gets into full swing, and we're going to start with the camera rehearsal on Monday, and then we'll start rolling contestants through this coming Tuesday. So I will be cranking out my normal podcasts. I really don't have time to watch Raw or SmackDown, and once I get on location, which is, if you listen to the show, you know that I live on location while we're filming 5 days out of the week. Most of the time, my satellite doesn't work. When my satellite does work, I don't have time to watch television anyway. So I'll put those on hold. Just be my regular podcast for the next couple of weeks, and we'll see what happens from there. I'm looking forward to this season of Broken Skull Challenge, man. It's going to be awesome. We've changed a lot of things. I told you guys at the end of season 4 that I was going to mow everything down and recreate it, and goddamn, that's exactly what we did. And the contestants this year are going to have a hell of a time navigating the challenges and the Skull Buster. So I'm looking forward to getting started. Part of getting started is getting my wardrobe together, getting all my t-shirts from ProWrestlingTees.com, working on some new designs. We got some cool artists on board working on some shit. Also, some of the artists from the past few seasons are chipping some t-shirts. So I think we got a pretty good selection of shirts. Getting those things all finalized up, getting some new tennis shoes. And goddamn, I'm taking my old pickup truck out there to haul all my weights out there. And I'm fixing to drive my pickup truck to the car wash. And that sumbitch been sitting underneath a tree for about 2 months. Haven't driven it a bit. And it has just got shit, bird shit, tree droppings, smog droppings all over it. Goddamn, the sumbitch is dirtier than hell. So I fixed to drive out there into the car wash. So when I roll out there to the Broken Skull Challenge compound on Saturday to drop a bunch of shit off, and then when I load everything up on Sunday, that's when I will start spending the night out there and getting ready for the grind and getting ready for the shoot, that my truck is looking proper. I tell you what, one of the things I'm looking forward to when I set up my compound out there, I have my power rack, I've got my Olympic barbell and some dumbbells that I take out there, and I take my assault air bike out there for my cardio. But this year I'm going to take my bow out there and a couple of targets. I pulled my bow back the other day. I didn't know if I was going to be able to pull my compound bow back. I don't know what my poundage is on that thing. It might be 60. That might be exaggerating, but it's in that ballpark. I was able to pull my bow back without any problem. And when I had that last shoulder repaired, I thought I might not be able to pull a bow back again. So I'm excited about taking that thing out there. Living here in Marina Del Rey, man, the yards are so small. I had a 20-yard target set up, but there's really no room for any kind of error, because if that error bounces off anything, you're probably going to shoot somebody in the head. So I don't shoot my bow too much when I'm at 316 Gimmick Street. Anyway, I'm looking forward to that. And just looking forward to it. One thing I'm going to miss, though, is I used to take Hershey the Wonder Dog out there with me. But ever since we got Moolah, they become such good friends that now I don't have a dog to take out there and spend a night with me. So it's just going to be me out there. But I enjoy. This is one of my favorite times of the year. First off, because I love hosting the Broken Skull Challenge. It's the best job in the world. I love having the best athletes in the United States come out there, the men and the women, absolutely putting everything on the line to show what they've got. From just my standpoint, I love to work. And then at nighttime when the sun goes down, man, I tell you what, it's just a real neat feeling to be outdoors again. I love camping, and when that sun goes down out there in those mountains, it's just kind of a magical atmosphere that comes out. I don't know what it is about those hills and mountains out there in the desert, but it's very, very cool, and you get some coyotes howling every now and then. It kind of makes me miss the days of the Broken Skull Ranch way down there in South Texas. Whole different vibe, but just being out there on a couple of hundred acres all by myself is it's fun for me. So I enjoy being out in the middle of nowhere. I enjoy the contestants. But once they get out of Dodge, hey, man, I got that whole place to myself. I ride around in my Kawasaki mules. I'm going to take out a I was wanting to get one of those grills that use the pellets, a pellet grill. And I'm going to get one of those. And I'm thinking if I cook my dinner, which is usually about a 6-ounce piece of salmon, if I throw my chicken breast on there while I'm using that grill, that'll be my food for the next day. So I'm trying to kill a couple of birds with one stone there rather than taking all my frozen meals out there, because those things start tasting like shit that my wife cooks for me. So I'm going to take a different approach here, try a pellet grill and see how that goes and see what kind of results I got. I had a piece of salmon that was cooked on a pellet grill when I visited my brother-in-law in Nevada, and it was absolutely delicious. So I'm going to give that a shot. Normally, I'm a gas grill guy. I ain't got time for that shit, but if I can just turn the knob on this motherfucker and get it kicked on, throw my shit on, and then go get it in 20 minutes, that might be right up my alley. But anyway, let me digress. Let me get back into the body of this podcast. Before I get to my conversation with Paul, I know it's hard to find good, hardworking, and talented employees. And if you're looking to fill a position at your company, then you need to get to ZipRecruiter.com so you can find the best candidates for the job you need to fill. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click, and then let ZipRecruiter do the rest. Their powerful technology matches the right people for your job, and that's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter does not depend on candidates finding you. ZipRecruiter finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. And here's the best part. You don't have to mess with sorting through emails or juggling calls to your office. You can simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. You heard me right. I said free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Steve. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Steve. One more time, for the hearing impaired, to post your job for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/Steve.
Hey, have you heard? Podcast One has a whole bunch of awesome new shows filled with big names that are waiting for you on our brand new amazing app. This one's a game changer. There's Norman Lear talking to Amy Poehler, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and Charles Barkley. Geffen Playhouse Unscripted with Bryan Cranston, Josh Gad, and soon Neil Patrick Harris.
Nice.
OC Real Housewife Heather Dubrow's World. Lady Gang's Three Mimosa Podcast with Leah Michelle, Nelly Furtado, Elle King, and more. Plus every episode of The Adam Carolla Show, Dan Patrick, and Rich Eisen. And if you like what happens in the ring, we've got Steve Austin, Chris Jericho, Chael Sonnen, and a whole bunch more. So download our one-of-a-kind new app and see for yourself. Go to the App Store, Google Play, or download it now at podcast1.com.
Steve Austin, Unleashed.
Talking with Paul Lazenby, my old stunt double from Vancouver, Canada. Welcome to the crib. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm doing great. It's great to be back on the show, and the crib is looking fantastic since the last time I saw it.
It's been a while since you've been over here.
Yeah, it's been a few years. I remember your whole saga outlined on previous episodes of the podcast about going through the renovation hell, but it paid off because it looks it was nice before. It looks substantially better now.
You know, I was talking to my wife the other day, and I was like, man, has Paul ever been over to this crib? Because, shit, the last time I remember seeing you, I thought we talked on the phone the last time, or was that in person?
No, we did it on Skype last time.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And I was like, man, last time I remember seeing Paul, unless something happened, was down at the ranch. But we saw each other before that.
Yeah, I think so. I forget which order it was, but yeah, I had been here before and I had been to the ranch as well.
Speaking of the ranch, you were one of the only human beings, Paul, that was an extended an invite to the Broken Skull Ranch. Oh, you sold it, and we're cool with it, but you were the only human beings that ever was invited to the Broken Skull Ranch. That speaks volumes as to how I like my privacy and just don't like anybody hanging around.
Well, I very much, I'll never fail to appreciate that because I'm the same way. Like, I always have to have my place where I go in, lock my door, and everybody just leave me the hell alone. So for you to want to bring me up to that isolated area and spend several days where you couldn't get away from my ass,
when Ric Flair came, he said it felt like he was in Afghanistan. It was so far away. So I think it's quite Afghanistan, but the good part, the high spot of the whole week for me was you stayed about 5-6 days.
Yeah, I think so.
So we were shooting and doing all kinds of stuff, riding around, having a good time. But one of the high spots for me was it rained cats and dogs before we left. And you had that little, what the fuck kind of car did you rent? It rained, but you needed four-wheel drive to get out. And what were you driving?
It was some kind of mid-size, like just a sedan. And because
it was a mid-size shit box.
It was a piece of garbage. But I didn't stop and think. I got to think about what Steve says in Texas terms, because you said, okay, there's about a 15-mile dirt road out of Tilden that we got to take to get to the ranch. Well, a dirt road in Vancouver terms is very different from a dirt road in Texas terms. Driving up there in dry conditions, I thought the car was going to shake apart. And so I thought there's no way I'm getting back with the road flooded out.
The potholes in that damn road. I mean, goddamn, if you had any fillings in your teeth, by the time you got from the county road to the gate, you'd check your teeth, make sure you still had your fillings all in. It was rougher than a goddamn cob. And when we first bought that ranch, it was just a gravel road. And hell, I'd be going 75 miles an hour down that gravel road, one lane, just for all the oil field hit out there, hauling ass, just smooth as butter. Just hauling ass down a gravel road. And then all the oil field trucks came out and they started putting in these massive potholes. And I'm thinking to myself, how in the fuck? I know it's 18 wheeler, but how in the fuck can just a truck with 18 wheels, rubber wheels with a bunch of weight on top of it, create all these potholes? Anybody got any ideas how potholes are created through the physics of having a rubber tire roll over them? Send it to questions at steveaustinshow.com and let me know. Because if I could put some time-lapse photography cameras out there, Paul, you work in the movie industry. We're going to get that in a little bit. If you can put a camera out there and just film that shit, you know how they do those long shots,
yeah,
with the sun coming up and all that other stuff, of a pothole being made by all these 18-wheelers. But goddamn, one time we rode out there, true story, straight-up shoot. This is one of the times where all the potholes were still in full force. They finally paved that road, Paul.
Oh, good.
They finally paved it. But before they did, it was Pothole City. We drove down in our RV. We timed it so that we could pick up Kristen's mother at the airport. You talk about vacation on steroids? Fuck the metallic P-Station wagon. We was in a big-ass 32-foot RV, picked up my mother-in-law from the airport. I left fucking two tracks of rubber burning out down the damn airport. We hit that county road. You ever been RV? Driving. Oh, yeah. I know you've been in your share of RVs because you're in the movie business, but RVs just driving around.
Yeah, I can only imagine what it was like on that road.
Little cattywampus. I mean, this is a super class C, but it was sturdy built. and everything was falling out of the cabinets. The dogs were in there. Kristen's mother was bouncing up and down like this. And Kristen's got a bad neck. And I'm like, God damn it. You know what? I can slow down. I can pussyfoot this motherfucker, drive 5 miles an hour, and it's going to take us an hour to get to the fucking ranch. And I said, fuck it. I might as well just hammer down. And so I said, fuck it. I was going 60 down that goddamn dirt road, bouncing my mother-in-law all over the place. She's a trooper. I said, goddamn, Marlene, put on your seatbelt. We're in a goddamn hurry. I was going to stop and get a Diablo sandwich and a Diet Dr. Pepper.
Well, I got a theory that actually that road was the inspiration for the Skull Buster on the Broken Skull Challenge, because what that road does to cars is apparently roughly equivalent to what the Skull Buster is doing to human beings.
Goddamn, if I took some of them OCR racers and Spartan racers and some of the elite cats I've had out there at the Broken Skull Challenge, that damn dirt road, I don't know if they'd live. But, well, yeah, it might have inspired the Skull Buster. But goddamn, it's funny because when I went out there, I flew down to San Antonio when I first bought that ranch. And took a look at it, and I couldn't get to see the whole thing because back then it was raining. So I saw about a half of the property, but what I saw I liked, and it turned out to be a great ranch. But I only went down there one time, flew back, talked it over with Kristen. I said, you know what? Let's go ahead and pull the trigger on this. I love McMullen County. I like where the ranch is at. It's very private. So we bought it. But then over the 10 years of going down that fucking dirt road and being slapped with all that work, I said, I won't beat a dead horse. My listeners have heard this story plenty of times before, but goddamn, I had a good time out there doing all that stupid shit. We shot about, I don't know, 2,000 rounds.
Something like that. We shot a lot of dead fish, too, because there was a drought going on.
You remember that?
Oh, yeah, vividly, man. I just think that's cool because I'm a city guy. I mean, if I want to shoot, I got to get my guns. I got to drive 45 minutes to the indoor range and check in and do all the shit. But in this case, you know, he just looked at me and said, you feel like shooting? And it was just a matter of going to your gun locker and getting a couple of pistols and going out back to the watering hole, shoot dead fish.
But tell people about the fish that we were shooting because of the situation. Like I said, when I bought that ranch, I mean, it had been raining cats and dogs. And I had five, we call them tanks. Other people in the cities or in other countries might think of them as ponds. But anyway, the bunch of tanks. And the heat was so extreme, the rain was so sparse, everything evaporated and dried up. So I had fish flopping around on top of the, you know, mud or dirt because the tanks had dried out. So I'd forgot that we were riding around capping a few fish.
Yeah, target practice. And we also used a couple of little spinner targets. I don't know if you remember the ones that looked like little croquet hoops and they got spinning plastic paddles. And this was a meeting of the mind, so to speak, man, because we're bouncing bullets off of those with 45s. And then at one point you went, I don't like the look of them rebounds. And you went and got, you know, as men do, we threw the instructions away when we unwrapped the damn things. And you went in the garbage and you got it out and said, do not use anything bigger than a .22 on these things. That would have been the dumbest way ever to die.
One of those ricochets whistled by my ear. And I was like, God damn, we got to be doing something wrong. Let's look at the horsepower rating on these things. 22s? Oh, we're not doing much better. We're shooting 45. God damn, Dirty Harry would have been proud of us.
I think so. So would the Darwin Awards, because we would have given them some material for their books.
Goddamn, where do you want to start this podcast? You want to talk about when we were bouncers, too? I've been on your IMDb page here on the internet. Lost in Space, a TV series, The Predator. Dude, when... You already filmed The Predator?
They're redoing The Predator. Yeah, they just wrapped filming. I think they're probably going to be doing some reshoots. It's due out for release next year. But yeah, I got a stunt actor role on that. And in fact, I'm very proud of this because I previously, just after Dusty Rhodes passed away, I played a wrestler on a TV series. And I wanted to work a little something into the scene, like have a wrestler wear RIP Dream on his arm or something. And it got vetoed. They didn't want to do it. So they were putting some tattoos on me as a biker, and I don't know if it's going to show on screen, but I actually got them to lay in RIP Dream on the inside of my forearm. So I'm hoping the camera catches it at some point.
That's awesome. Hey, speaking of wrestlers, check out my physique. What am I sporting right now?
You are sporting, oh yeah, you got a little band on your left arm looking like you you had to tie off for some particular reason.
I got a red elastic, whatever you call it, gimmick.
Tensor band or...
Yeah, you put a Band-Aid when they take your blood. I went and dropped off a pint of blood this morning, so they put a Band-Aid on there, and then they wrap it with this bright colored wrap. And so today the color is red. I just gave blood today. I took off my sticker so I wouldn't look like a fucking mark. Then some bully saw me. Hey, the big bald-headed guy over there, he just gave a pint of blood. Let's whoop the fuck out of him. Then I looked like a target. Fuck that. Homie too smart for that street shit. Yeah, so I put on a sticker. Back off, bitch. I ain't getting no blood. Back to my story. So they put this damn bandana on my arms, and it reminded me of the story I told on a podcast before, but I had never told you. So one time I was in Beverly Hills, I was dropping off some blood, and god dang, the gal was having a hard time finding a vein. And most of the time I'm pretty vascular if I'm getting lean, but the damn building was so cold, all my veins were shrunk up. They stuck me three times. And they said, you know, the final time, on the third time, they said, well, if this one doesn't take, I might have you stick you one more time. And I'm like, well, I got three gimmicks. And I said, finally, it wasn't doing anything. Wasn't filling up the bag. I mean, it was a shit. So I'm thinking, what the fuck? My blood must be, you know, thick as molasses. I'm going to die here. And so anyway, finally, she hits a damn gusher, and it starts flowing like a motherfucker. But by the time I left, I had four holes in my arms. They'd then switched out arms, hit me in the hands, and so they had me tied off on both arms. And this is when I walked out of the blood donor center, and I'd parked on in a metered parking, and it says no parking after 3 p.m. Well, shit, I didn't know it was going to take all day to get a pint of blood, so they hauled my goddamn SUV off. And so the impound lot was 0.8 miles away, almost a mile. We got to stop by the police department before you get your damn vehicle. And this is in Beverly Hills, goddammit. I'm wearing camouflage shorts and a shirt like this. Can right you in. Believe it? Fit right in. Everybody in Beverly Hills wears camo shirts and a sleeveless dry fit tank top, right? So, but now I'm walking across here like a fucking cretin. A cretin is the word I'll use. I got both arms tied off, look like the... A shitty version of the Ultimate Warrior, or maybe even the Warlord. A gun's taped off, anemic as hell, just took about three pints of my blood, stuck like hell. I look like a fucking idiot. And I know people, because like I was sitting there thinking, you know, in the movies, in the big cities, New York City, Boston, Chicago, dare I say, Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, you just walk out of a building and go... Taxi! And one of those motherfuckers just magically rolls up. I'm on the busiest fucking corner line of Wilshire and Beverly Hills, so I'm thinking there gotta be a damn cab driver just gonna happen by and pick me up. I'm watching them cars. Yeah. But there's a reason there's metered parking, no parking after 3 p.m. because it's rush hour. I tried to whistle down a couple of them. They just looked at me like, you fucking Mark, we ain't going to stop over here and get killed trying to pick your jabroni ass up. Anyway, that's the story that reminds me of sitting here talking to you on the podcast. When you showed up and saw that tied off, I knew that I didn't want you to know that I'd, you know, I probably saved a couple of lives giving this blood here, Paul.
Oh, I think so. I think actually it's a good thing that they don't tell people who the blood's coming from, because there'd be a lot of fist fights over who gets a
pint of Steve Austin's blood. Me and the guy was sitting there talking football, and I was ribbing the guy. I said, he goes, man, he goes, you drop off a lot of blood, don't you? I like to go every 2 months and keep a fresh supply and help a brother out. He says, man, you've been giving a lot of blood. I said, yeah, I just like to, you know, keep my system clean. And I said, I'm surprised some of the shit I dropped off in here ain't melted a couple of those bags. You got a kick out of that. Because there have been some times that are coming in off a bender. It's like, let's see how the bag holds up.
Well, so some people probably got a free buzz.
Dude, if you get a pint of my shit, what I want to do, I want to get a pint of Cali. We've got a little black lab next door. She's about 5 months old. You talk about gangbusters. If I get a pint of her blood and get that kind of energy, mister, I got the cure.
Dude, you're making a comeback. Yeah. There's a WrestleMania main event of your future if you get Cali blood in your system.
God damn it. So is the Predator going to be any good?
I'm hoping so. Like, I know very little about it. They're real secretive about the project, so they gave me my lines, and I know what happened in my scene, and I had to sign this non-disclosure agreement. Gotcha. About that much. But it's looking like it's a different take on it, and I've talked to a couple people who worked on the whole thing front to back, and they're optimistic that it's going to be good.
Well, who is the lead, or can you talk about that? Is that
Yeah, I mean, the cast is on IMDb already, okay. So that's already out. But the one guy I recognize, cause, to be honest, I didn't recognize a lot of the names. They're successful actors, but not super huge stars. Shane Black is a director, which is a huge, weighs heavily in the movie's favor. That guy's got a great track record. And Keegan-Michael Key is the comedian. He's one of the guys. So that shows they might be taking a different direction with this thing. But right. I'm definitely not going to pass judgment one way or the other based on my scene. My scene will be excellent, of course, because I'm in it. Yeah. I'm you know, the new Laurence Olivier is at least in that part. So the movie's going to be a success based on that. But outside of it, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it myself.
On a couple of low-budget movies that I did in Canada, you were my stunt double. I was surprised that you were in this major blockbuster and you didn't call me and just at least give me a chance to be your stunt double because you were a featured or numbered actor on the call sheet.
Well, I didn't want to break it to you, but I've ascended to a level as an actor now where you know I kind of had to remove myself from medium-level success people professionally. We're still friends, don't get me wrong, but... You know, professionally, we had to go our separate ways at some point. I did bring your name up, and they just went, I don't know, man. Like, that guy's still working his way up the ladder.
Here's the thing. It's funny. When Paul was first going to start doubling me, he's watching me walk around the set, and they noticed that my right arm doesn't straighten out. So I was watching him. His right arm wouldn't straighten out. And I was like, Jesus Christ, this fucking guy's a real piece of work. What a perfectionist. You going to fucking mimic the gimmick elbow that doesn't straighten out, you cocksucker? What a pro. I don't know if you was being a pro or ribbing me. Which one was it?
It's a combination. Actually, this is kind of weird, actually. My arm doesn't straighten out all the way. It's
okay,
not
you quite, weren't acting.
No, we got a similar injury in that way. Yours is yours doesn't straighten out to a greater degree than mine, but no, I actually walk with it a little mildly bent. So
years from now, there will be a table just like the one we're sitting at a restaurant with two skeletons just sitting there opposing each other, and there will be a piece of paper in the middle that was the bill. What happened to these guys? Neither one of them could reach the paper. Neither one of them could reach his ticket, so they both starved to death and died. Our legacy. Put us in the Smithsonian. What an exhibit that will be.
That'd be something.
Cheapskate 1 and Cheapskate 2 from BC.
It would make some art gallery, yeah, if not the Smithsonian. You know, some art gallery.
Some of the shit I've seen in art galleries that doesn't need to be in art galleries, I think that should be in an art gallery.
Absolutely, yeah.
A global icon and a national treasure and a cat from Vancouver. I had to get my shit back on you.
Ouch.
You got a receipt coming? In the business, we used to throw a right hand. A receipt can be a verbal receipt here on the podcast. Dude, what are you doing down here in Los Angeles? It's good to see you. You look like $1 million, but what brought you to town?
Well, thanks. I just like to drop everything and go whenever there's something I want to do. I spent most of my adult life not making any money, so there were always things that I wanted to go see and do and stuff, and I couldn't. So now I jump on the opportunity. And they had the New Japan is having their first American shows, part of their annual G1 tournament. And I wanted to see that. That was a chance to meet up with Don Callis again. He's an old friend of mine. And chance to see you. Maybe I'm going to try to see Boss Rootin' while I'm here. You know, just hook up with some L.A. people that I haven't seen for a while.
What did you think about the show? As we talk, now this show happens a little bit back. But
yeah.
This was fresh because you and me were sitting there in production truck watching the whole thing together. What was your take?
I enjoyed it. I mean, there was some real good stuff happened on it. They started strong. It was... Maybe not to everybody's taste, but the 10-man tag at the beginning, which is just all kinds of craziness and high spots and stuff like that, definitely got the crowd up for the rest of the show. And then there were some performances that night that just blew me away. I mean, it's good to see Juice Robinson getting some North American exposure because I didn't know really much about that guy until I went to Japan this past January for the Tokyo Dome show. And he worked Cody Rhodes then, and I was extremely impressed with Juice and realized I got to start paying more attention to this guy. So I'm glad to see him getting a little bit of eyes on him in North America. Cody against Okada was you know, we talked about it in the production truck. You know, Okada's selling reminded me of an old Japanese worker named Kiyoshi Tamura in that it was just unbelievably masterful and really brought the match up.
I thought, going back to the Juice Robinson match, man, I hadn't really heard of the guy because I'm not into – I barely watch WWE. I try to watch Raw and SmackDown. I DVR both shows. I try to watch as much as I can. Now that I know that New Japan is on Access, I can watch more of it. Channel 340 if you have DirecTV. So now I want to watch more of it. But, man, when Juice went out there and he worked Zack Sabre Jr., that was one of my favorite matches of the night. Just the holes that Zack was employing. Jesus Christ, what a technician this guy is. Come from that England background of technical wrestling. And Juice selling that damn arm. And he had good fire, working the crowd good, but not pandering to the crowd. That was one of my favorite matches. I really enjoyed that match. I enjoyed Cody's match with Okada. And there was just, you know, standard fare, kind of going back and forth those first 10, 12 minutes, putting the time in, you know, trying to get the story going. Cody playing the part of the heel, kissing his wife a few times over in the corner. But when they finally settled into the match, but then when Cody started getting some heat and then started, he grabbed that, what's that hold call he grabbed on Okada? Someone called it, I thought Josh called it a calf slicer.
Yeah, it was a modified calf slicer. It reminded me of an Indian deathlock, actually.
Well, whatever it's called, it was a leg hold, and that's when Okada kicked in the Shakespearean Theater, and I was like, holy shit, man. That was awesome selling. I mean, that's what it's all about. And so I just thought they had a great match. I really enjoyed it. So, I mean, it was fun. I just got to see, dude was working pretty snug, and there was some good work in the ring.
Yeah, it was wrestling. I mean, a lot of people have fallen off the WWE product because there's been emphasis on things outside the ring, and the in-ring product has changed. This is wrestling for people who like wrestling. I mean, and of course, we've got to mention Kenny Omega just lit it up again. That guy just does not have a match that's not spectacular. In there with Michael Elgin, one of the most beastly strong and still agile guys in the business. So they definitely didn't disappoint either.
No, they did a good job. I really enjoyed the finishing sequence. The last 5 minutes was pretty epic. Going back, I want to mention one last thing in that Cody Okada match was when Kenny Omega came down with the towel,
yeah,
which came off the angle when Cody had the towel and wanted to throw it in, maybe to stop Omega from taking more punishment from Okada and Omega Okada 2. Mm-hmm. There was Cody. And so to see the storyline play out or the angle play out there at the first show in America, at the G1 was really cool. That here comes Kenny and talking with Brandy, trying to get Brandy, Cody's wife, to throw the towel in. It was just a good little bit of a storyline because it added to the match. And so the crowd was pretty pensive at first. And then, boy, that spot, the heat spot with, or not the heat spot, but just the heat area when Cody grabbed that leg hold, that's when the match really started picking up. That's when it started building and they had a damn good finish.
Yeah, I like to see the fact that there are people like Omega bringing storytelling back into a prominent position in the business, because there's nothing, if you like Spot Fest, that's great. You know, go to PWG shows and there's nothing wrong with that. But myself, I want to see more than a Cirque du Soleil act. So it can't just be car crash wrestling every match on the card. And I like seeing an emphasis on storytelling. I actually did go to one PWG show. That's Pro Wrestling Guerrilla for people that aren't familiar with it. And generally, they're very spot-heavy shows. It's where all the boys go to just have fun, and the crowd's all in on it. Like the crowd's almost treated like the boys. And they flip and fly for the whole show. And again, that's great if it's your thing. But I was kind of getting burned out by intermission because there's so much talent in there, but they were all doing the same things. They were all going crazy. There's all fireworks going off every single match. 20 minutes to midnight, the semi-main event goes in. Hot building, burned-out crowd. And Kyle O'Reilly and Chris Hero went in there and just wrestled for 40 minutes. They didn't come off the top rope. They didn't do fly-throughs. They didn't do anything spectacular, crazy. They told a story. There were times they were on the same spot on the canvas for 5 minutes straight, and they got the crowd back. And this was a crowd of people who like high spots.
Right.
And they still were rejuvenated because, oh, you're telling us a story we can get into, we can engage. And it took some patience, and it built and built and built to a finish. So that showed me that even if spot monkeys are your thing, and that's fine, you will still respond to storytelling, where the reverse isn't necessarily true. And that's why we always need storytellers like Kenny Omega and Cody Rhodes and other guys like Okada, who are going to tell us those, address psychology, because it's very much needed.
Man, I'll tell you what, the match that surprised me, it was a tournament match, was when Naito got beat by Ishii.
Mm.
And I was thinking Naito is going to move on. It was just that character walking down that damn ramp with that suit on and that laissez-faire attitude and trying to get the referee. Red Shoes was awesome.
Oh, yeah.
The whole night. And the thing he did with the Young Bucks and Kenny Omega, they were trying to get him to do the whatever,
the too sweet.
Yeah. And he gave him the cross shot.
So deadpan, too.
The Naito Ishii match was a little bit of comedy in the beginning. Not comedy, but, you know, when you hit the ropes and go into a pose, mm-hmm, laying on the mat. But then towards the end, the last 10 minutes were brutal. I mean, those two dudes are beating the shit out of each other. Yeah. They were bringing it. So you're talking about tough as nails. And so, dude, even just the head slaps.
Yeah, well, that's, Ishii matches generally are hard-hitting. Like, that's one dude that I'm actually concerned about because I love watching him work, but he just, Togi Makabe is another guy that I wonder about because they just wrestle such a brutal, hard-hitting style all the time. And we've seen that kind of style take its toll on previous All Japan wrestlers, especially where they used to lay into each other. But for now, it's entertaining as hell. And I heard that Ishii wasn't necessarily 100% happy with the match because he's such a perfectionist, but I think he's being too hard on himself, man. I thought that was a great match.
I thought I really, like I said, I liked the final 10 minutes more than the entirety of the match. But was it a good match or a bad match? Yeah, it was a good match. But I loved the last 10 minutes. When I was watching that setup, one of the things that I noticed on a couple of the high-risk maneuvers, and there wasn't a whole bunch, and I was glad for that. I mean, there's some hard-hitting stuff, but nothing crazy high-risk. I think Kenny did one of the things. But just their ring position, by the way they have that ring, and then they have that next level, and then they have the floor. Man, I don't know about that setup. It seems to me like you can come up with a better setup that's going to be safer for the guys if they're going to be doing any kind of outside the ring action.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much consideration was given to the layout of the venue. And again, I'm not going to second guess anything New Japan does. They're doing a good job of running their shows, but I know what you mean. Like, there's just the logistics of the building were a bit strange to me for what's supposed to be New Japan's coming out party in North America. I would have thought there were different things that they could have done to make it a bit more grandiose. And like you said, accommodate the boys a little bit more.
But I mean, it goes back to, I think, you know, when Rick Rude hurt his back, I believe it was over in Japan, if I'm not mistaken. And it was due to kind of a similar stage, setup type thing. And I was like, man, 2017, you know, clear out that ringside area, whatever, you know, make it a little bit safe for the guys to spill out if they're going to spill out and do their shit.
Well, there was even a case where I think it was Kenny Omega took a bump into the guardrail, and that whole section of guardrail fell into the crowd. Like, how do you set up your guardrails and not have them all connected? Because you don't want to be crushing your front row, man. Those people paid a lot of money for tickets. They don't need to be going to the hospital.
Hey, man, the one little spot in that match, we'll move on and talk about some other stuff, but the one spot in that match when Kenny picked up Michael Elgin is a pretty good display of strength, because Michael Elgin's a big, solid dude and bottom heavy with those legs. He's just a big dude. And that when he picked him up, remember that gut wrench into kind of like a powerbomb type gimmick or whatever his finish is called. But I looked over at you and I kind of raised my eyes. I said, dude, that's a pretty good display of strength for a dude that size.
Well, especially late in the match. And yeah, he had to hold him up and manipulate his body weight, like turn Elgin around in the air. And it really shocked me. I know Kenny's been working hard. Like, anybody who's been paying attention to him has seen that he's been put on a lot of quality mass in the last little while. But he's a lot stronger than even I anticipated.
What would you think about that guy in an American promotion? Could he be the guy?
Kenny Omega, if they let him. I mean, that's the story of a lot of talent right now, is that in North American wrestling, you get the opportunities that are given to you. But it also, from my perspective anyway, seems like there's a lot of times where the company decides whether or not you're going to get over. And if they decide you're not the guy, then you're not allowed to turn yourself into the guy. They'll hamstring that. And I'm not sure, from what I understand of Kenny Omega, he's a guy that really likes his creative freedom. He likes to be able to expand his character as opposed to being wearing creative handcuffs, so to speak. And so I'm not sure how much he would be able to thrive in, say, the WWE environment where they're micromanage their talent a lot more.
When I look at his in-ring ability, and when I've seen some of his promos, that the X Factor that he brings to that, and just as a persona, I think he could be the guy. But like you said, does he have the talent and ability to be the guy? Yes, he does, and he has a good look. But it's whether the system or the company, what you're saying, they have to make up their mind that, hey, this is our guy. But I believe he has enough X Factor to garner a larger audience than is watching right now. Mm. I just think he's a magnificent worker. He just seems like he's got a lot of charisma. There's just something about the kid. If you put the company and made him a focal point, I think he could be that guy.
Yeah, you hear the phrase "it factor" thrown around a lot in WWE, and that dude has it in spades. Absolutely, you know, he's got the complete package. He's got that intangible charisma that a really top guy needs to have. And yeah, if they wind him up and let him go, then he can main event WrestleMania and sell all kinds of pay-per-views and tickets and whatever for him.
Hey, man, let's take a commercial break here and come back after possible calls to sponsors to keep the show on the air. Two cans of audio whoop ass for free. God damn, all you got to do is hit the download button. Paul, where can people find you on social media, your website, any kind of information?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Famous Bouncers. And also on Twitter, my personal account is at MaulerMMA.
All right, we're coming right back with Paul Lazenby. He's going to carry me as we go into another segment talking about when we were bouncers too. I ain't been carried in a long time. We'll see if Paul is up to the task. True Car is one of the longtime sponsors of this podcast, and it's all you need if you're looking to buy a new or used car. True Car gives you the price and information you need to feel confident about your purchase. When you register with True Car, you will see what other people in your local area paid for the car that you want. And from there, you can connect with a local True Car certified dealer and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. True Car shows you real pricing on actual inventory, so you see competitive pricing offered to you by True Car certified dealers for vehicles that are actually on their lots. And you'll also see all the dealer incentives before you get to the lot, so you can feel confident about the price when you show up. True Car makes car buying easy, no matter if you're looking for a brand new or used vehicle. And here's the thing, the stats don't lie. Over 3 million cars have been sold to True Car users by the True Car Certified Dealer Network. There are over 13,000 dealers in that network, with some 700,000 pre-owned vehicles available. So do yourself a favor and go to True Car for your next car buying experience. True Car doesn't just make the process easier, it will also save you some money. True Car users save an average of over $3,000 off MSRP. So when you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit True Car to enjoy a better car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
There are 120,000 unsolved murder cases in America.
It was the next day that I found out from my parents what had happened, that my sister was killed.
Each one is called a cold case.
Sometimes you have to look really closely to find the evidence.
Damn it, I killed her.
Damn it, I killed her.
Cold Case Files, the podcast.
Garcia is walking into the home of a real monster.
I was nervous. I realized what kind of person I was dealing with.
It's a goosebump moment.
Download new episodes every Tuesday on the Podcast One app or subscribe at Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.
Steve Austin. Steve Austin. Unleashed. Unleashed.
Rolling sound back here, Paul Lazenby, Marina Del Rey. Hotter than a motherfucker outside. Got the ceiling fan going. Got a cold breeze going through here. Paul's completely full of shit. So am I. And you're listening. Thanks for the download button. Hey, man. It's been a while since you've been on the show. And the last time you was on the show, you said there's a couple things that you'd like to talk about.
Yeah. It actually, because when you invited me back on again, I went back and listened to my other two appearances to see what I talked about then. And there's something, the first time I was on the show, two, three years ago, I think, something like that, I said one of the dumbest and most ignorant things I've ever said in my life, and it makes me cringe to think that it's still out there. I was talking about my time wrestling as a character called Death Wolf in Insane Championship Wrestling, not the one that's doing very well in Scotland right now. This is a Detroit-based group. Now they're called XICW. I think they're the oldest homegrown group in Michigan. But that was run by the late Malcolm Monroe and a guy named A.T. Huck, who's still running it to this day, and you know, great guys, great promoters. And just an unbelievably talent-rich locker room. A lot of guys who ended up going to WWE or really making it in wrestling. And at one point I was talking about, I was lucky enough to be popular in that group, and I said I was selling their building out for them. And I could not have sounded more like an asshole wrestler than making that statement and basically slapping the faces of everybody involved in ICW. So I want to send out a public apology for making that dumb fucking statement that should never come out of my mouth. I like to think I was a cog in the wheel. I like to think I played my part in making that the popular promotion that it was, but in no way, shape, or form was I selling their building out for them. I was doing my part to sell tickets, and so were a lot of other people, and Malcolm and Huck were working their asses off too. So sorry, guys.
Did you get any heat over that?
No, nobody's really, there was a little bit of backlash from fans online. I made a reference that the next time I come on the show, I should talk about it. And then I forgot the second time I came on. But I immediately apologized to the fans that contacted me. There were a few people from Detroit that said, well, what do you mean by that? Because these guys are there too. And I'm like, you know what, guys, you got me. You're right. You're totally right. And so, yeah, apologies all around.
All right, so you made it good. But let me ask you something about your memory right now. Man, every time we're talking about, what's the Tomorrow guy, the Japanese wrestler?
The
guy that sells real good.
Oh, Okada.
No, the other guy.
Oh, Tamura. I'm sorry. Yeah. Kiyoshi Tamura.
So, dude, every time you're talking about guys that are in the business or different guys you've trained with or guys that were trainers and all these different disciplines and the names you just spit out right now, dude, after all the chair shots, all the bullshit, all the bouncing, all the movies, and Brain still good? You got a memory like a steel trap. I can't remember shit. I don't even remember your name.
I know you've been frowning at me. Like, I don't even think you know who I am right now.
What the fuck is this guy's name?
Just rest assured, I am a friend.
You know when you meet somebody and this happened last night, a guy come up to me and he goes, "Hey, man, how's it going?" We shook hands. This is at the New Japan Pro Wrestling Show. He goes, "Hey, man, how you doing?" I said, "Good." And I kind of give him that look and he goes, "Dude, you remember who I am, don't you?" I said, "No." It was one of those moments he had to explain who he was. I felt like a piece of shit. But anyway, I just didn't remember who the guy was. I think he changed his look. Anyway, so your memory's still good and no problems?
It's okay. I'm having a lot of short-term memory issues that I'm doing a good job of managing, but it came down to concussions as well. I was always one of those fighters when I was fighting who could walk through stuff, and that was basically my way of beating guys. If they get tired of hitting me, and then I knock them out or take them to a decision. But even guys who are genetically gifted and not getting knocked out, you're still getting concussions when you're getting hit. And then I did a gag on the TV show Arrow a couple of years ago, an ankle snare trap, you know, one of those gimmicks where your ankle gets caught by a cable and then it gets pulled over your head, so your hand upside down. And it was kind of a violent whipping motion, and the riggers were working out the way they were going to do it. So we did it 10 times in a row. And just my brain bounced around in my skull from that. That was the concussion that I've been wearing since then. I remember my brain being real foggy. James Bamford, Bam Bam, you know him, know him well. I called him up because he was the stunt coordinator at the time and just said, "Look, dude, I know I got lines tomorrow. If there's any way I can do the lines first, please let me know because I may forget my name when we do the gag." But thankfully, it wasn't as bad the second night. But I did that 15 times in the space of 2 days, and it just it took away some of my short-term memory. So I really am conscious of focusing on trying to remember stuff now. But yeah, I lose names all the time.
When you say you're trying to work on it, what are you doing to try to be proactive?
A lot of reading, I try to stay off my phone as much as possible. I try to stay away from TV as much as possible. I still watch TV and use my phone a lot, but I kind of equate it this way is, when you're using your phone or you're online, it's external stimuli. Like you're plugging stimulus into your head as opposed to creating it inside your head. It's kind of like using one of those little electrode gimmicks and sticking it to your muscle and making it flex as opposed to lifting a weight and making the muscle work and building it from the inside out. And the second way is the best way. So I think when you're doing creative stuff or when you're reading or actually trying to flex your mental muscles, it can kind of bring that back, just the way physio brings back your muscles when you're injured. And so I'm doing a lot of that, and it has been helping. It's brought back a little bit of the short-term memory that I lost. But long-term memory doesn't tend to be as affected by concussions, and yeah, that's why I can remember all this wrestling stuff because I've been living that for so long.
Yeah, so that's what's going on with me then, huh? All right, so I got that to look forward to. Got to start working on the mental capacity. Got to start reading more. Check. Hey, segueing off of what you just said, keeping your face out of your iPhone or your smartphone, whatever you're carrying over there, you've been driving around the streets of Los Angeles for a couple of days now. Have you noticed every motherfucker that's driving is texting while they're driving?
Yes, absolutely.
Does it drive you crazy or what?
Yeah.
This kills me. I know I've beaten a dead horse. I talk about this shit all the time, but that's how much it irritates me. You just came in from Vancouver. So I want to get your thoughts on it, because there's shit going on in Vancouver too.
Yeah, it's just as bad there. I mean, everybody is glued to their iPhones now. And, you know, I'm guilty of it sometimes too, but it's gotten to be a real problem where people get anxious if they're away from their phone. I deliberately leave my phone at home sometimes, and I'll walk outside the house and for like 2 or 3 minutes, I actually feel anxious. Like, oh, I'm not connected to this thing. And that makes me realize I need to be away from it for a while. But there are people who never have it out of their hand. They wake up, they pick it up, and it's with them all day long, and they can't not look at it while they're driving. You know, the pedestrians walking out in front of you texting, when you almost hit them and lay them out, they don't even care. It is becoming a real bad deal, and I think people need to start realizing that you need time away from technology as well, as great as it is.
Hey, man, I was sitting there thinking about smartphones and stuff like that. I was walking the streets of Vancouver a couple of years back. I had my iPhone with me, but I had my camera with me. And I was walking around some of the neighborhoods. I'd left the hotel. I'd walked about 3 miles. I was taking pictures of, just the landscape, the hardscape, the buildings and stuff, the architecture. I was really getting a lot of good pictures of graffiti because I always just love the artistic flair to graffiti. So I started getting some shady, you know, areas of town. As you know, you can quickly find a Vancouver.
Oh, hell yeah.
It's a great city. I love it. It's beautiful. But there's some sketchy areas over there. So anyway, I'm riding along. I mean, I'm walking along. And all of a sudden, you know, this is before the cop comes to see me. This cop pulls over. He goes, "Hey, aren't you Stone Cold Steve Austin?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm just walking around taking pictures of graffiti." He goes, "Well, hell, you want to ride with me? I can take you to see all kinds of graffiti. I said, well, yeah. Shit, I jumped in a shotgun seat with the cop, and we went all over, you know, the bad side of B.C., and so I'm safe as a lamb in there with him. And I don't think anybody's going to jump me, but I got some good pictures. But before that happened, I wasn't on my iPhone, but I'll never forget this. I told a story on a podcast before. I was about to step off a curb, and I didn't look both ways. One of the few times in my life I didn't have my head on a swivel and look both ways. Folks, in the past, you've always heard me give you tips like carry jumper cables, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, a four-way screwdriver, a pocket knife, those kind of tips. Look both ways before you cross the street. Goddamn, I stepped down that street, Paul, and this motherfucking smart car. A smart car almost demolished a global icon and a national treasure. And I got to say, if I'd have stepped out there and that car would have hit me and just T-boned me, I don't know if it would have killed the driver or would have killed me. I don't know who would have got the worst end of the deal. But if indeed Steve Austin, the man formerly known as Stone Cold Steve Austin, got killed by a chump-ass smart car on the mean streets of Vancouver, B.C., shit.
I would have had to disavow all knowledge of ever having known you, man. That would just be too embarrassing to even be associated with.
I wouldn't even want no one to get sad. That stupid motherfucker. Hey, whatever happened to Stone Cold? Dude was over in Vancouver shooting a low-budget movie with Lazenby. Dumbass got hit by a smart car and died. Fuck that.
You know I'd be catching heat for that. What you doing luring Stone Cold up to Vancouver to get hit by a roller skate?
God damn, I remember we was filming that one movie when I had infiltrated a Russian mob. And they were going to blow my family up, my wife and my daughter. And they were in a piece of shit car in my driveway. And I was driving a pretty sweet SUV, had about a 400 grand crib in a movie. It was a sweet setup. My wife and my kid was in some hunk of shit that we could set on fire for the budget of the movie. Had flame bars built in, and they was going to hit the flame bars. And, you know, sort of like the car had just been blown up, and it was a fiery mess. And I'm beating on the window trying to get my family out there, burning to a crisp. I'm crying. I got to save mom and my little baby girl. We walked up to the goddamn car. It was a couple of blow-up sex dolls with wigs and raggedy in makeup. Rouge on the cheeks. Had the gimmick blowjob mouth.
That was absolutely obscene, especially because you had the actresses there, one of whom was like 7 years old, and her stand-in for this scene, her stunt double, was a sex doll with a blowjob mouth.
It was bad, and the fucking director, Rob Lieberman, what's his name?
Rob Lieberman.
Rob Lieberman had a fucking global meltdown. God, you're undercutting me at every turn. This is nothing but schlock. I'm thinking, okay, in about 5 minutes when he says action, they blow up the car, I'm pounding on the fucking window, channeling my inner Daniel Day-Lewis with all these pent-up emotions. My whole marriage is flashing by with the birth of my baby daughter, and they're fucking burning in a car, and they're blowjob dolls from the fucking sex store down the fucking street. Holy smokes, you talk about method.
Hey, you should be proud of yourself, man. If you can pull that off, then you have a real future in the film business.
But right before that, we was doing a thing where you were going to do a stunt off an air ramp. Explain what an air ramp is.
Air ramp is a compressed air catapult. So you step on it, and it's either pressure activated where you step and then it fires, or somebody else will trigger it. You know, you can trigger it yourself with a thumb trigger, or somebody else will fire it from off to the side. And it, like I said, it's a catapult. You stand on it and it throws you. So these things are so freaking powerful. The first time I rode one, I weighed 260 pounds, and that thing threw me 7 feet up and 30 feet straight ahead, and it wasn't even turned all the way up. So they're extremely dangerous. You can get killed on these things. People have really gotten maimed badly from riding them wrong. You got to ride them perfect.
But when you say ride, you step, and when you say the ride, but that's because of the air compressor. You got to kind of have, you don't want to have your legs totally locked. But to explain the technique behind that when you say ride, because they throw you the fuck off.
Yeah, actually, you do. In that case, you do want your knee totally locked, because this thing is so powerful. You're stepping on the platform, and then it's going right away, and is the catapult is going up with such power. If your knee's bent, nobody in the world is strong enough to hold a bent leg under that kind of force, and it'll just take your knee and clap it up underneath your chin and tear your hip out and everything. So you actually have to land directly on it with a locked knee, and then your skeletal structure keeps you in the right position, and you got to make sure you're falling forward. If you fall backward, you're going to flip ass over tea kettle and fall on the equipment or fall backward. It just, a lot of stuff can go wrong with those things. So that was actually the most dangerous gag of my career, because I'm trying to save the blowjob dolls. And I got, they forgot some stuff that we're going to be doing that day. So I get there and it's like, okay, Paul, yeah, you got, you know, your buddy Chad Bellamy is going to be triggering it from off the side. That's cool. I know Chad, you know, he's on top of it. Now it starts to rain. So now there's going to be, you know, the lid might be slippery, what I'm standing on. And then I got to stand there. And then, oh, yeah, the car's blown up. So we got to shoot flames in your face. So here's a big glob of fire gel. We're going to smear all over your face. And you got to keep your eyes shut while you do it now. Oh, and when you're in the air, can you turn your head away from camera so that we don't see that it's not Steve? And so on and so on. There's so many curveballs got thrown. And I had almost, I come very close to breaking my neck rehearsing that gag into pads. And the whopper was 2 days before when they said, oh, yeah, by the way, we were doing a tech survey, and we're seeing the lawn that you're landing on, so we can't give you pads to land on. So I'm getting thrown up.
This is like one rib after a rib after a rib.
I was just like, I am so dead. This is going to be the last day of my career. But, yeah, I got thrown up backwards with flames shooting in my face, 6 feet up, about 12 feet back, land on my head on the lawn. And Lash, the stunt coordinator, actually, he just went and told him, he said, you better shoot the hell out of this, because I'm not, if he's able to do a second take, I'm not letting him, because this is dangerous. And managed to nail it. You know, I was so happy. I hit the ground, got a little bit of whiplash, but all good, rolled through. Everything went well. And this is before I knew you well enough to ask you to pull rank, which it was just killing me to this day, because you went over to Video Village after you found out I was okay, and you went to the video guy was showing you the footage of the gag. And then we're walking away. You're walking away, and I'm walking toward it so I can go look at it. And you shook my hand and said, good job. And then I went up, and the guy's already ripping out cables. He goes, oh, no, screw you. You don't get to see it. And in the final product of the movie, you don't even see the gag. There's, like, Steve trying to save the doll, big fireball, and then me laying on the lawn. So most dangerous gag of my career. I've never seen it.
God damn it. I hate it when that happens. On that note, you know, so many things, like I think it was another extravaganza. A blockbuster that we're filming up there, and we were going to do a fight. I had to kill about 15 bikers in this movie. I had just blown out my left rotator cuff. Remember that?
Yeah, recoil.
Recoil. God damn it, man. Best-selling bikers. I go into a pool hall. We're going to have a goddamn hellacious fight inside that pool hall. All of a sudden, they bust out the gimmick pool cue, you know, and that's what I want to end up breaking that pool cue and in it to beat some ass. Well, first take, we shattered that son of a bitch as expected. Okay, stunts, fly in the next gimmick pool cue. We only got one. And, dude, I got a torn rotator cuff, and I just found this out prior to shooting. And a normal person would say, hey, we got to halt production. I got a torn rotator cuff. I can't really fight. If you'll notice, all of the fights in that movie are done with my right arm because the left arm is down. And I was pretty much holding my hand in my pocket, eating Vicodin to get through the shoot. And so we had to y'all had to redo all the fights because of the choreography. I could only use one arm. You remember this?
Yeah. We had to shoot anything that required the left arm, I had to do, and they just shoot it from behind me or whatever.
But goddamn, dude, when you roll into a pool hall and someone said, hey, man, you know, we're going to do a fight in a pool hall, you got to have a shitload of gimmicks. And so we only had one gimmick pool cue. And so then we started using a real pool cue, and you and the other guys would say, what was it? It was
Bam Bam, actually. Bam Bam? James Bamford.
And Bam Bam said, just go ahead and hit me for real. I said, dude, I can't do that. As I ate another Vicodin Plus, Vicodin ES. And he said, dude, you got to do what you got to do. I said, all right, dude, I'll do the best I can. But, you know, it was a clusterfuck.
Well, that was funny, too, because there is a way to take a lot of the stink off it, so to speak, if you're hitting somebody with a real stick. But nobody had shown you how to do that. So you're trying to take care of Bam Bam as much as you can. But, you know, he ended up purple on his thigh. No fault of yours. And the horrible thing was, it was actually later when I was visiting the Broken Skull Ranch. And I said, oh, remember that thing with Bam Bam? Why don't you try doing this? And you picked it up right away. But they didn't give you any time to learn it. If they had given you 10 minutes before shooting that scene, you would have been able to pick it up, and it would have been a lot less sucky for him. But that's the way things go sometimes.
Dude, enough about the low-budget movies. I'm sorry I segued there. I wanted to talk about When We Were Bouncers, too. Tell me about this illustrious book. I got through half of it. I didn't get through all of it. You know my reading acumen, but I did get through the first one, and I wrote the foreword for When We Were Bouncers, too, because I enjoyed the first one so much. How did this book come together? How'd you round up all these stories?
Basically the same way I did the first one. For people who aren't acquainted with the franchise so far, When We Were Bouncers is a collection of stories from famous people who used to be bouncers and security personnel telling their stories from their days of doing those jobs. And the stories are completely insane. You know, Volume 1's got people like Samoa Joe, like Theo Rossi from Sons of Anarchy. You know, it's got some big, big names in there. And the stories just kept piling in. You know, one thing I found with this franchise or with this project is that I cold contact people all the time, and very, very seldom does anybody even hesitate to jump on board. You know, bouncers always want to tell their old war stories and security guards. So it connected with pretty much everybody I contacted, and I piled up the story so quick I had more than a book's worth. So when We Were Bouncers 2 came into fruition, I'm already working on number 3, as well as being in talks with I have been in talks with the El Rey Network. I'm not sure where they're going with regards to a possible TV series. You know, it just it's been building all kinds of momentum, and I've got no plans to stop anytime soon because it just keeps going.
So every time you call somebody, they got shit piles of stories?
Just about. You know, anybody who bounced for any length of time has crazy stories. And that's what I was thinking when I first put the project together is I always wondered why there was never a bouncer book that did well, because I bounced for roughly 20 years and you see the most insane shit. It's just ridiculous. You see life from an angle nobody else does. And then I realized it's probably because nobody likes bouncers. You know, bouncers are always telling you what to do, where you can't go or you can't get in, or you know, punching you in your face or whatever. So then I realized, you know, I'm lucky enough to know a lot of famous people. And so that's the hook to get people to listen to the stories is, okay, I might not like bouncers, but I like Ty Olson, the star of Supernatural, or I like Ken Shamrock, the UFC legend, or I like Chris Jericho. Well, they're all in here. So, you know, I might not like bouncers, but I'm a Fozzie fan or a WWE fan. I like Chris Jericho. Let's hear his bouncer stories. And they're crazy. So then that it just, you know, I've very, very seldom got anything but a stellar response from readers. Even people like yourself who, you know, have a tough time sitting down and reading for a long length of time, you can read this in very short increments. You can read it for like 2 minutes at a time if you want.
How's a standard cold call go for you?
Usually online, and I'll just reach out to people and say, this is, you know, I'll refer them to whenwewerebouncers.com, which is my base website, and say, this is my project. And I'll say, these are the people who've already gotten on board. And that's what's making it easier now, is I've got people like yourself attached to the project. If I can drop that name, and that's how our mutual friend C.T. Fletcher ended up in the book, is that, you know, he said, look, I don't do interviews that often, but if Stone Cold's involved in this, you know, I've got so much respect for him, I'm going to be involved too. And being a man of his word, he gave me some of the most insane stories I've ever heard in my life. By the way, I thank you for letting me know. You know, CT's had some heart issues lately, and I'm just texted him. I'm happy to hear that he's on the mend, so get well soon, CT. And by the way, anybody who's in the Signal Hill area of California, Iron Addicts is legit a gym as you are going to get to, man. That thing is ultra hardcore. I trained there yesterday. Thanks to David Ruiz for letting me work in with you, so I don't have to wait for an hour for a bench. And I can't recommend that strongly enough.
Dude, you're looking pretty buff. What are you doing with your training program right now? And what'd you do at Iron Addicts? Aren't you on a heavy powerlifting cycle right now?
Yes, I am. And I didn't want to interrupt that, which is why I was glad to have access to Iron Addicts. But I got a guy named Mike Mannarino in Vancouver. He's a world record holding deadlifter. / full three lift powerlifter. He runs a company called Forza Barbell. It's like a semi-private gym. And I showed you the video yesterday as we're recording this. That little bastard at a body weight of a drug-free 192 pounds pulled 710-pound deadlift. And he's got a competition coming up next week. He's going to shoot at 725. So he obviously knows what he's doing. You know, I've known him for a couple years, and even though he's so young, he's accumulated information and processed it and learned how to train himself and other people really well. And a lot of his clients are doing well. So initially we were just training partners. And at some point I thought, you know, I got to get in on some of this. And I turned my training over to him, and man, my bench has been going up, my deadlift's going up, and you know, my physique's getting better. So he obviously knows what he's doing.
So what's the difference between what he's got you doing versus what you were doing?
I fell into certain habits. I guess when you're a powerlifter at heart, then it's easy to get a little bit lazy as far as doing high volume work, like high reps. I want to go in, I want to pull like heavy single deadlifts. So I want to do maybe sets of 3, maybe 5 of squats and bench. But there are benefits of mixing in high volume work as well, and mixing in isolation work that contributes to your strength in the big 3, squat, bench, deadlift. And there's a formula to that, and there's a system to that I've never really had the patience to sit down and learn. So Mike's done that for me, and so I that's incorporated in now. That Ruiz guy I was talking about that I was training with yesterday, he's a powerlifter too, and he was remarking on the number of reps I was doing. He said, that level of volume is kind of crazy from what I'm used to. And but it's been working for me. You know, I'm getting stronger and my physique's looking better.
So then how often are you hitting the big three lifts?
Well, I'm benching once a week, incline pressing once a week. And then deadlifting, I really had to learn that being an old man deadlifter is different from being a young man deadlifter. I was deadlifting once a week, and that ended up being too much. That is a whole body exercise that taxes you so much. Now it's once every 2 to 3 weeks.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, and you, surprisingly, you don't lose your strength when you're doing it every second.
So what are you doing on the days between on a back day? Are you doing rack pulls? Are you doing heavy bent overs? I mean, are you just... what's your accessory back work?
Not a lot of accessory work. My accessory back work I do on bench day, and it's generally a lot of high rep rows. You know, like cable rows and dumbbell rows, stuff like that.
See, that's why I always get lost. If I get on a program, or if I back in the day we get on a program, you know, whether I'm focusing on bench or all three, is related to a one rep max. And here's my percentages, and here's my rep scheme. Mm. Okay, then what would always tangle me up would be with respect to the accessory work. Probably doing too much accessory work because I want to look like a bodybuilder, but yeah. I'm trying to get strong. So I would cross the two up and fuck myself up.
Yeah, and I was probably guilty of some of that too when I was in phases where I wanted to address my physique. But you can be a bodybuilder or you can be a powerlifter. Now I'm finding out there's ways to be a good-looking powerlifter too, but you just got to do it scientifically and do it right. And that's why I'm glad Mike's doing my thinking for me, because I don't think I ever would have untangled that knot by myself.
That's cool. I'm back with Paul Lazenby. If Stacy left that break in there, I hit the pause button, and we took a pause for the cause, took care of business over here, and hit the record button. Well, right before I hit the record button, I looked at Paul and said, what were we talking about? We're about 5 or 10 minutes in a rack in our brains, and Paul goes, oh, yeah, concussions and short-term memory.
This does not bode well for our old age.
I don't know how the segue is going to leave off or the segue is going to stay in or what the fuck, but you know this show is a one-man clusterfuck today. Paul Lazenby joins me in this clusterfuck. Before we take it home, you got any final thoughts, stories you want to talk about? When we were bouncers, too, where you want to go with this? I'm an open channel. I'll go wherever you want to go. Just call the match.
I'm going to throw one last plug in because the response has just been so encouraging. I want to keep things rolling with this thing. Sales have been great. You know, they seem to be going up every month, and I'm really hopeful that we're going to get that TV series When We Were Bouncers off the ground. Talking to a couple other people besides El Rey, so we'll see. But yeah, once again, this is easy, light reading for the Twitter generation. If you only want to sit down and read something for 5 minutes, you can knock off one or two stories out of here. It's reading for the bus. It's reading for, you know, sneaking up behind your school books or whatever. And if you want to sit down, you want to plow through a book front to back, you can do that too. So stories about Mike Tyson, stories about Kimbo Slice, stories about Ken Shamrock, the UFC guy, TV stars, movie stars, all kinds of stuff. You're going to find them all in here. You can pick it up at whenwewerebouncers.com, or you can get it straight off Amazon, or just go to your local bookstore and they can order it in for you.
So how did you co-call Mike Tyson?
Well, it was stories about Mike Tyson. So actually that is the chapter from MVP, the former WWE superstar MVP. And his chapter blew me away because he's got stories, in-depth stories about Kimbo Slice, Mike Tyson, Shannon Doherty, and there's one or two other famous figures in there as well. And like he had real, like the story goes on for like a full page about everything he went through with these people. So he was in a real high-end nightclub in Miami, so a lot of big names came through there. And as a result, his chapter is a real standout chapter.
I saw Mike Tyson a couple of months ago. They were over to Ritz-Carlton in Marina Del Rey, and we were walking out. We had been drinking margaritas for about 2 hours. Man, I was feeling good. And all of a sudden, man, I seen this guy with a big posse, a lot of people. Man, it was Iron Mike Tyson with his wife, his kids, his whole family. They were going over, I think they were going to Hawaii or somewhere. But anyway, I said, God damn, I said, Mike. He looked at me. God damn, we did it. You know, shook hands and hugged and everything. It was good to see him again because, man, doing business with that guy way back in the day, you know, when he came out and I interrupted that big announcement that Vince made, and we had the big, you know, I give him the double flip off, and he pushed me. God damn, he gave me a good chest shove. I mean, he threw me back, and I was going for him, dude. It was a damn near shoot. It was a work, but I mean, we were damn near shooting. I'm glad that those guys are really trying to hold me back because I was trying to get to Mike, and had I got to Mike, he'd have knocked me out. I got to thank my old buddy, Jerry Briscoe, that salty motherfucker chicken wing suplex me over in Kuwait. Jerry, you motherfucker, I'll never forget it. But anyway, Sarge and some of those other guys. But it was shoot. They was trying to hold me back, and it was just a great moment. That dude, he's had a hell of a damn life, he's fucked up a few times, but goddamn, he's just a good dude.
Well, yeah, I mean, he was basically a wild animal that he's like Tarzan. You know, they pulled him out of the jungle. In his case, the jungle was the rough area that he was living in, and they taught him how to thump people into unconsciousness. But, you know, nobody was really handing this guy the tools for life. And so you shoot up to the top like that, you become one of the most famous people in the world, and you become super successful at a young age like that, then, yeah, people are going to step on their dick, so to speak. And one thing I always admire about Mike is that he's always owned his mistakes. Hear him talk about his life, and he will be very honest about the mistakes he's made, and he will accept responsibility for them. And that's a disturbingly rare thing right now, as people usually want to deflect responsibility. So I admire that dude for what he's been able to do and to, you know, kind of pull out of his tailspin, so to speak, and make something of his life on the back end of his fight career.
I'm looking to talk to him one of these days on a podcast. If you ever pass through, if I ever catch you, Mike, if you hear this podcast, I'm looking for you. Would love to talk to you on the Steve Austin Show. Hey, man, I'm going to wrap this thing up. Paul, one more time, a drive-by, social media, website. Where can people find you?
You can find me at whenwewerebouncers.com and on Instagram and Twitter, at Famous Bouncers or at Mahler MMA. And if I may be so bold, I know you're in the habit of recommending a match of the week in pro wrestling terms.
Go for it.
I would like to strongly recommend one of my two favorite wrestling matches of all time, and that is the guy that we both greatly admire, the late Doug Furnas, one of the greatest powerlifters of all time, a spectacular pro wrestler, and a guy who was very good to me in the early part of my pro wrestling career, Phil LaFon, a.k.a. Dan Crawford. They were a tag team called the Can-Am Express in the early 90s in All Japan, and just absolute world-class elite. They had a match for the All-Asia Tag Titles, defending them against Kenta Kobashi and Tsuyoshi Kikuchi, K-I-K-U-C-H-I. You can find that on YouTube. It is one of the most incredible tag team matches I've ever seen in my life. You know, you often hear about Kenny Omega versus Okada being a six-star match. If you're going to call that a six-star match, you got to call this one a six-star match, too. I watch it at least two, three times a year. And I really like, especially now that Doug Furnas is no longer with us and none of those guys are in the wrestling game anymore, I think it would be really good for them to be remembered for their entire careers, but especially for that match.
I'm going to watch that back, and I will file a field report on the podcast as well. Paul, good seeing you. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks a lot for having me back on the show, man. I really appreciate it.
All right, everybody, give me the go-home cues. Time to wrap up this podcast and ride off in the sunset. Before I do that, I want to thank my buddy old Paul Lazenby, my stunt double up there in Vancouver, British Columbia, coming by the house. Also, I want to thank him for giving me a ride home from the New Japan show that night. I took an Uber up there, and then Paul offered to drive me home. Me, him, and Don Callis booked the territory, got everybody over, and saved the business. Shout out to Paul Lazenby. Don Callis is coming up on a future podcast here in a week or so. We recorded that one podcast that you already heard, and then I recorded an Evergreen podcast with Don Callis, so he will be back on the show in a couple of weeks. And if you have not heard his podcast with Lance Storm called Killing the Town, give it a listen. It's under the Jericho Network at podcastone.com. It's a free download, just like my show. Don Callis and Lance Storm, Killing the Town. Check it out. Hey, here's a quick plug for you. ProWrestlingTees.com/Steve Austin has all the shirts I'm fixing to wear on Broken Skull Challenge Season 5 that will be available very, very soon. My IPA is the best IPA on planet Earth. It's called Steve Austin's Broken Skull IPA, and you can find it at Whole Foods and Total Wines if you live in California. I've been getting a lot of feedback from people here in Cali that cannot find it at both of those stores. I'm going to check in to see why that beer isn't at some of the Whole Foods and Total Wines, because if it's supposed to be there, it needs to be there, because I'm giving you my word. If you ain't in Cali, check out InsideTheCellar.com and see if they ship to your state. And if you're looking to get either the Cold Steel Broken Skull Knife or the new Working Man's Knife, you can get them at my new Amazon store. Amazon has the best prices on both knives. Just go to amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin. Some people have been sending me questions asking me what's the difference between the Broken Skull and the Working Man pocket knife. The difference is the Broken Skull is a 4-inch blade. The Working Man is a 3.5-inch blade.
The broken skull is a little bit more expensive. The working man, a little more cost-effective. So both are extremely high-quality knives. Both have a hell of an edge. Both are badass knives. Hey, I got to say one more thank you to all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show. That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. You can find all of my sponsors at podcastone.com. Just click on the Killer Deals button at the top of the page and then click on the Steve Austin Show banner. If you want to follow me on Twitter and on Instagram, my handles are Steve Austin, BSR, on both. Folks, keep listening. I've got Wade Keller coming up at the end of the show, and then be sure to stick around for the AP News headlines right after Wade. Until then, my name is Steve Austin. We're about to roll camera on Broken Skull Challenge, the toughest, baddest, coolest show on TV, and that's the bottom line, and I'll catch your ass down the road.
Thanks for listening to Steve Austin Unleashed. Catch new episodes every Thursday on the Podcast One app or subscribe at Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.
God damn, I just hit the record button. I'm sitting here trying to make heads or tails out of everything I just saw, watching as much as I could of SmackDown, fast-forwarding to the commercials, then fast-forwarding to the commercials on DVR, on Raw, and finally coming to the classic ending of Monday Night Raw. I watch them backwards. I watch Tuesday first and don't watch Monday on the DVR. But I've got Wade Keller on the line, and this is my wrestling segment. And therefore, since Wade is the one that watches the business way more than I do, I'm going to chip in. Wade, let's go with SmackDown first, since that's what I watched, and paid attention to the most. What were your takeaways from SmackDown?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was a variety of ways to promote a pay-per-view that's coming up on Sunday. You know, you had a main event match with Jinder Mahal and Randy Orton, where you advertise the structure, the Punjabi prison, and you want people to be excited about seeing a Punjabi prison match, so you show off the structure. And you don't have the opponents attack. You don't have them get physical, but you have them exchange words. And you have Randy talk about the importance of the title. You have the heel talk about what it means to keep the title. So they talked about the championship during the segment enough for my taste, too. So that worked. And then you had a situation with John Cena and Rusev, where Cena cuts the ultra-patriotic promo leading into a flag match, which makes sense. You have Russo sneak attack him from behind. And when Rusev sneak attacks him from behind, that leads to a reason for John Cena to want to make for John Cena fans to want to see him make a comeback when he's not being attacked from behind, but is standing face to face with Rusev in a fair situation. So that works, but it's different than the Orton Jinder push, even though it's a baby face against a foreign menace. And then you have kind of the traditional two singles matches. Let's put two of the pairs of wrestlers together in a tag team match in the main event, have 10 minutes of good action, tease what you're going to get when it's one-on-one, and have a challenger pin the champion. And if it's a heel doing it, they got to cheat a little bit to do it so that it doesn't seem like a burial of the babyface. And they did that too. And so overall, I mean, I think when you look at it, they used a variety of techniques to build anticipation for Battleground on Sunday without giving away too much action between the wrestlers that they're trying to get you to buy to see on the network. So that's kind of my quick overview of SmackDown.
What was in that assessment of putting the talent together in a tag match, which match are you referring to?
Oh, the main event, AJ Styles and Shinsuke Nakamura versus Kevin Owens and Baron Corbin. And in the end, U.S. title challenger Kevin Owens pinned AJ Styles after countering a Styles clash. And Owens ends up coming in and kind of blindsiding Styles with a kick to the face and then hitting his pop-up powerbomb.
You know, what was the best part of that match in your estimation? Because I'll tell you my best part of that match.
I mean, I saw it as – I'm not sure that anything's jumping out to me. I saw it as, yeah, formulaic. Babyface takes a beat down for a while, teases a hot tag, eventually gets it. That babyface takes a beat down for a while, teases a hot tag, finally gets it. And then there's some chaos, and then there's a blindside due to heel shenanigans, and the heel wins, and now you want to see the face one-on-one get revenge on Sunday.
So, like you said, just setting things up for the pay-per-view.
Yeah.
The best part of that match, though, was AJ Styles' comeback. And he didn't just go there and do a bunch of stuff. He did kind of trademark AJ stuff. But here's what he did that jumped out from the rest of the match with everybody involved. He had tremendous fire. He's laying his shit in. He was ready to go. I think he sensed that crowd wasn't the greatest crowd in the world, at least the way my TV was bringing it to me. But it was just like, hey, man, he just said, fuck this, and he started bringing his shit like he always does. And that was the highlight of the match, is watching AJ do his comeback because of his intensity level. He meant what he was doing. He brought the match up. I thought the action just kind of prior to that was going through the paces. We got a big pay-per-view coming up. You're setting the table. I get that. But his intensity was the thing that jumped out at me in that match. And I thought everybody in the match should have been on the same page with AJ, in my opinion.
And I think one of my thoughts coming out of that match is AJ seemed like the star, and Shinsuke seems like he belongs, but he's not jumping off the page. And I'm still waiting for that moment. And I'm not sure if Baron Corbin is going to provide that moment for him. I think it's going to happen when AJ and Shinsuke finally face off. AJ and Shinsuke had a backstage segment, and Shinsuke looked at AJ and pointed at the U.S. title and said, you know, one time when you have an open challenge, watch out, because I'll answer it. So they've been dropping hints that this friendship, this alliance, it's not going to prevent Shinsuke from wanting a U.S. title shot.
Well, I'm looking forward to him locking up with AJ and having a match, because, you know, the backstage segment, you know, there's AJ, and then Shinsuke enters frame, however it went, and he points down the title just like he said. I don't know, man. He's just coming across as a guy in the locker room, and, man, I'm a fan. So this is the King of Strong Style. I keep going back at it, and people say, hey, fuck, Steve, get off of it. Hey, it's King of Strong Style. I mean, I don't know if that's more like digging into gimmick infringement for Baron Corbin, but I would picture Shinsuke as kind of a lone wolf type cat, like a Stone Cold was or whatever. So, you know, he just comes in there and he's kind of smiling. It's just almost like they're making him a regular guy. And I still see this charismatic guy who's a badass, and he can really go when he wants to. And so I guess that's really what I want to see out of the guy. Okay, while I'm on that, there was two things that jumped off at me. One of them might have been the pay-per-view. Yeah, I think it was that. Maybe you and I were talking before we started the last podcast. And I think Michael Cole said, this is sports entertainment at its finest. And I was like, God dang, man, Brock and Joe are fixing to go. I bought in. I'm a big fan. I wrestled in the business 15 years. And that two guys that I consider great workers and good friends of Brock, you know, casual friends, a lot of respect for Joe. And all of a sudden, man, you just killed my moment. Hey, man, just say, if you don't want to call it wrestling, just say it doesn't get any better than this. Don't say this is sports entertainment at its finest, because as I was watching, who's on Raw? Is Revival on Raw?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I watch the shows back to back. So then right there, it was one of the guys on commentary. The Revival has taken tag team sports entertainment to another level. Tag team sports entertainment. You just shot me in the leg again.
Yep.
Is wrestling a four-letter word? Is it banned? Does it almost start with F? God dang. I mean,
yeah.
Come on, Wade.
You're preaching to the choir. You are absolutely not. I agree with everything you say. It grates on my ears. It doesn't sound right. It sounds corporate. It sounds forced. And just stay away from the term. Like, you know, they've started to say words like competitor and competition more often, or athlete, or something like that, as opposed to, you know, sports entertainer. If you want to classify what you do as sports entertainment to the trade press and the media and at conferences, that's fine. But I don't really know why those two words ever need to be uttered on the show, because you're reminding people it's sports, but the implication of entertainment is, right, it's not real. That's what people hear when they hear that word. because obviously the NBA is sports entertainment. People pay to be entertained watching sports. So everything, all sports is entertainment if people pay to see it or show up to watch it. So it just doesn't really mean anything, but it doesn't sound right to wrestling fans. I don't think it helps sell tickets. And I think the content on your show from start to finish, the words you utter should help you sell your product and get people invested and immersed in what you're watching. That word, like you said, it's like getting shot in the leg. It's a toe stub in the middle of being involved in what's going on. It takes you out of the moment.
Man, you know,
it's a losing battle.
That's just one of the things I just really don't want to say, because I don't want to just go completely negative. But it's like, God dang, I know they put the E in place of the F, you know, for the World Wildlife Fund, you know, turn into sports entertainment. But just when you hear that in the middle of trying, dude, I'm a hardcore veteran of the business. I love the business. I love the company. I love WWF. Just don't kill me while I'm trying to suspend my disbelief. That's a killer for me. Okay, I don't want to beat a dead horse. That jumped out to me more than the Kurt Angle angle. Your thoughts on the Kurt Angle angle?
Okay, it overwhelmingly negative response in my Twitter poll.
Really?
I mean, last I looked, over 1,500 responses, and it was about 74% thumbs down. I wouldn't say people were necessarily all hostile towards it, but they were let down. Now, I don't know. Part of it is the buildup was, this is scandalous and something that Kurt Angle should feel shame for and would be scared to admit. And I don't think anybody's shocked that Kurt Angle might have been sexually active in college and had a girlfriend. So,
Hang on. Let me pop. Hang on. Okay, continue, Wade, with your theory.
Yeah, so I'm not quite sure where the shock value comes in there, that it's not a scandal. It's something that was kept from Kurt, and now he's going public with it. There's nothing that he should have felt. How does that – if you had a child that you didn't know about, how does that destroy your current family? Like, so my point in this is – I mean, I'm just to pick on that aspect of a little bit, because they were trying to build it up as this big scandal – and then when the reveal came, it was this sweet, heartwarming moment of a father and son, long-lost son, reunited for the first time, so to speak. So that's not scandalous. And I think so. Some people giving it a thumbs down wanted something more tawdry. And I think they felt it was a little bit of a bait and switch. So I think that was part of it. 34% said it was a bad payoff. Actually, it's up to 2,600 votes right now. 34% bad payoff, 40% flat payoff. So that's the 74% thumbs down. 21% said good, 5% only said great. So even those who liked it, pretty tepid. I'm in this frustrating spot where I'm more nuanced, because to me it depends on where it goes. I can forgive, you know, criticize a little bit some of the, you know, hyping it up in a way that the announcement felt like a letdown to a lot of people when it happened. I can be critical of that, but also see potential going forward. And there's potential that this is going to turn somebody who I think has been vastly underutilized in Jason Jordan into a big star. And if this is how we have to get there, that's fine. Now, is he forever going to be Kurt Angle's son? Well, I mean, there's been forgotten storylines before, but it could also turn out one of the options that a lot of people are speculating about is maybe it's a con. Maybe he's not really his son, and it's an orchestrated plot to try to undermine Kurt Angle in some way, and that'll play out over the next 6 months. And if it's done well, it's a big if, but if it's done well, I can live with that if it leads to a payoff that involves Jason Jordan becoming a bigger star and getting a chance to prove himself. If Jordan flops in this role, then he got his chance and he flopped. I don't think he will, but we haven't seen a lot of range with him yet. So far, he's been a bright white teeth, happy-go-lucky, all-American, smiling. It's been this heartwarming story so far. And the Renee Young interview on WWE Network with Kurt Angle, it went like 8-10 minutes. It was heartwarming, and they covered some of the bases of how this all played out to try to fill in some plot holes. And for every not nitpick, but for every little hole maybe in the logic, I think they've thought through some other aspects of it that not every storyline like this actually has going for it. So I'm intrigued, but a little worried too that this will end up being kind of cornball or not have logic as it plays out, and they'll kind of take some they'll be sort of flexible in adhering to the history of the storyline as they go forward.
I like the fact that they're shooting a hell of a big angle. And, you know, you got a lot of negative response, but hey, man, it was a big time response, seemingly, from everybody, just as far as being in tune with the product or being in tune with sports entertainment. I like to call it wrestling. So anyways, a big time angle, a lot of rub for the kid, and he's a good looking guy. I read about him, while I was coming over here to talk to you on the podcast, outstanding credentials as an amateur. So, I mean, you know, could possibly have a bright future ahead of him. So if it's, you know, done off the back of this angle, more power to the kid. Good luck to him. But on the backside of it, you know, I think, you know, is this leading, I guess my big question out of this is this leading to a betrayal of Kurt's trust or someone trying to set him up to oust him from his position, and will result in Kurt Angle making a return to the ring to wrestle in a big-time pay-per-view?
I think that's the most logical. And that maybe some people see that as an understatement. I talked to somebody tonight who hadn't thought about this yet. They just thought it was Jordan getting a push as Kurt Angle's son, and that it wasn't leading ever. So I don't think it's safe to assume everybody's looking at all the possibilities, but I think the most likely scenario, and I think if you read into the emphasis on the word I, standing for integrity, which I believe was in the Renee Young network interview that followed Raw, they were, you know, Renee's like, oh, looks like your son has one of those eyes, integrity. And it was really underlined, you know, like Vince McMahon would do. And then Chad Gable on SmackDown tonight, you know, saying, well, Jordan was kind of distant. He wasn't really himself in recent weeks. And he did this without telling me. And we're partners. And this affects me too. They're laying some groundwork for callback moments of, okay, you know, we should have seen this coming for the fans who didn't. It doesn't guarantee it's going to happen. But yeah, I mean, I think the authority doesn't want, and Stephanie McMahon doesn't like Kurt Angle being in charge of, quote, her show. So they could orchestrate a plot to undercut Kurt, maybe drive him crazy, break his heart, cause him to do something that would get him to violate the terms of his employment, whatever it is. I'm excited to go on the ride, even if I think I know where it's going. And then, yes, I think we see Triple H versus Kurt Angle. Despite Triple H's charitable work on the ESPYs that we saw a video of on Raw, I think Triple H will be the bad guy and take on Kurt Angle at WrestleMania next year. And I think that's probably where it's headed.
Well, I love Kurt Angle. I think everybody does. He's one of the greatest ever step in the ring. So as a means or whatever to propel the kid and to facilitate an angle between Kurt Angle and whoever, if it goes down that road, I'm willing to jump on a ride too. It was a little bit far-fetched, but I'm on the ride, so it is what it is. We'll see how it shakes out. But here's what I was going to ask you about. Samoa Joe and Roman Reigns were having a pretty good match on Monday Night Raw, and then all of a sudden out comes Braun Strowman and wreaks havoc on the two combatants inside the squared circle. Give me your thoughts on, first of all, the match, and then Braun Strowman introducing himself to the match and ruining the match.
Well, it's a continuation of Samoa Joe being treated like he belongs in the ring with Vince McMahon's number one project, Roman Reigns. And Roman keeps getting better, and Samoa Joe is absolutely getting an unapologetic push as Reigns's, I don't know if I'd say equal. He's beat him twice, so in a way he's above him, but in other ways he's, you know, no one's thinking Joe's going to be taking Reigns' place as the top guy in the roster for a variety of reasons. But he's right there, and this is a continuation of it. This was a chance, and I thought there was a chance, that they would put Reigns over Joe. And that Samoa Joe, this, you know, Joe got two wins, Reigns would win, Reigns would go on to WrestleMania one-on-one with Brock, and Joe would just move on to something else. And that'd be fine. Joe would still be in a better place than I imagined 4 months ago he'd be. But instead, they, quote, protected Joe by having Braun run in. I don't know where SummerSlam lands in terms of if it's going to be a triple threat, a four-way, or they do a rematch Joe and Reigns, or Angle due to the distress and his being all distracted by his new son Jason Jordan, if he just makes some arbitrary call that doesn't need logic because we forgive Kurt because his mind is elsewhere. I don't know where it's going to go, but Braun Strowman is so freaking over right now that, and Jim Ross wrote about this too, he is a monster character babyface that's going to make money for WWE for years, and it's just a matter of when do they decide to cast him officially as a babyface, which comes from matching him up primarily against heels. But boy, did the crowd pop for Braun.
Well, they popped for him, but here was my takeaway from it. You know, the guy was having an okay match, and, you know, I don't know if it's going to be a three-way or what they're going to do in that pay-per-view. So I figure, you know, they're introducing Braun. But when Braun came out, he got the pop that you talked of, and I didn't think the crowd was great in that building. Maybe I didn't have my TV turned up loud enough. But, yeah, yes, for sure, he got a positive response.
Yeah.
And it didn't blow the roof off the building. But then after the damage was done, I felt that either the angle lingered too much, he stayed too long, these guys were fighting for the right to fight Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam, and so you're looking for that finish. He destroyed the possibility of that finish. So then, yeah, although they popped for him, when he left, it was not the same as when he came out.
I think that's fair. Yeah. And I think that's absolutely fair to say that it might have gone on a little too long. Like, he teased leaving the ring and then went back in, if I remember right. Like, put his leg over the top rope and then, no, I'm going to go back for more. And I think it's this idea of, you know, that Vince still has in his mind Strowman's a heel. And a heel would go back and beat up fallen foes even more. But I think the fans see that either you've overstayed your welcome, you popped us, it was a big moment, now get out, don't overstay, or the fans are just – some fans are probably like, yeah, more Braun. Just beat them up, especially if they're anti-Reigns, which, you know, 30 to 70% of the crowd is anti-Reigns, depending on the city. They might like Braun doing that more. But, yeah, I mean, when you say that, I agree that I thought when he left – when he was going to leave the ring the first time, I thought that, in retrospect, would have been a better time to leave than to go back and do more, especially if there is some thought to turning a babyface or just going with the babyface pops.
Well, because right now the tide is, you know, everybody, you know, he's seemingly a babyface, but they haven't really turned him. I don't know if they will ever officially turn him. Let's go back to Seth Rollins. Seth Rollins came back from that devastating knee injury, but it was a bad one. Took him out of the business for a while, and he comes back. The people want him organically as a babyface because they're happy to see Seth freaking Rollins back, and they want to just keep him as a heel. So, man, there was a natural tide. There was a natural wave of enthusiasm and emotion for him to make his comeback, and then he had to maintain the heel position because that's what they wanted him to do, and that was the time to turn, you know, Seth Rollins organically babyface, and I think he'd be more over now than he is. And the same thing with Braun. I mean, you kind of keep him in this never land or in the gray area, but, you know, when the people want to start buying into you and you're getting those kind of pops and you go into the murky waters of disturbing this match of two guys who are fighting for a right at that, you know, a shot at that title, and then you muck everything up, do your thing, get the fuck out of Dodge. It's like Triple H always says, every week is another story, or it's a continuation of the story. Okay, I know the story is going to continue because it's episodic television every single Monday and Tuesday, so I'll tune in, but don't dilly-dally too much with this thing. You're going to screw up the kid's momentum or the big picture and just dilute it all.
Well, and I think the crowd, you know, was flat for the Jason Jordan announcement. That was not a big pop. That was not a embracing the storyline. But I think WWE might have thought, we gave them a reveal. We gave them the payoff. Jason Jordan is Kurt Angle's son. So we don't need to do the payoff to the other big selling point on the show, which is who's going to be the main event at SummerSlam. And we have a good excuse for Kurt Angle not making a decision because he's preoccupied with his new son. And even Renee Young, on the first question she asked Kurt is, what's your ruling on this match? And Angle's like, I'll worry about that later. All I can think about is my wonderful son. So, you know, in their mind, I think they had a storyline reason to drag it out and leave that as a hook and play that out because they got a few more weeks of SummerSlam hype yet to go. But yeah, I mean, hey, can you think of anybody, Steve, that just comes to mind besides more a contemporary example like Seth, where they stepped in the pile of proverbial shit when they were feeling, when the feeling was this might work and it was a setback or it just killed somebody off?
No, I mean, nothing jumps to mind, you know, specifically right now. And I really enjoyed the promo between Seth and Dean Ambrose. I don't know where they're going with this. If these guys are going to end up, you know, Seth, you know, offering his back to Dean Ambrose, take that chair shot at him. I thought Dean really delivered his end of the promo well, and as did Seth too. And, you know, I like that angle. I like that promo stuff that both those guys did, because I thought, you know, I didn't know what direction they were headed, what they're going to do with them. Now I'm back invested with those guys. And the only reason I bring that up, because I'm happy Seth Rollins is finding solid ground again, because like I said, when he could have been a babyface back in the day and then they want to remain heel, and now all this work to kind of regain his momentum, the kid's got all the talent in the world. Just like to see more character development and see him do more stuff like this, which is engaging and it makes you care. And then I'm not trying to not answer your question. I can't really think of anybody specifically. Can you think of anybody like that?
No. I mean, I was trying to listen to you and also kind of think if there was anybody that jumped out, not just in WWF history, but, you know, WCW or other companies. And, I mean, there's probably some people who
If I put my mind to it, I'm sure both of us could think of some people, but that was just something that presented itself. One other thing, god dang, what was that other angle that I wanted to talk about? Oh, yeah, angle. It wasn't an angle. It was Fandango and Tyler Breeze. Jesus Christ, pulling the horse head out of the box. God damn it, I popped. I rewound that segment twice. And then the fucking Fandango, when they thought it was a UFO, and here comes the delivery guy. Oh, he feels so lifelike.
You breathe air. You are so human-like. You and I both like these. I mean, not every week's been great. I mean, there's been a couple stinkers or that overstayed their welcome, speaking of which. This wasn't one of them. From the opening, the R-Truth is out there. You know, doing the X-Files theme, or Bo Leave, the caption underneath a flying saucer, like all the little details that they put into it. But, and then hearing a ghost sound and it's Aiden English, you know, warming up behind a curtain. That was not even the high point of the skit, but I thought everything worked. Tyler, you know, Fandango's deadpan and Tyler Breeze just putting himself out there the way that he does, cross-dressing and being the ditzy one. It's worth people going out of their way to watch this. If it's your style of sense of humor. I mean, if it's not, it won't work for you. But
it's so corny, I can't help but like it. Yep. And I give props to both guys for pulling it off. They're doing an outstanding job. You know, when you say, hey, WWE, and that's the entertainment part of it, I dig it. So it'll be interesting to see who they're going to work with at the upcoming pay-per-view. So, but the horse head, the actions and the reactions was tremendous. It's in the category for me as in Southpaw Wrestling. God dang, when they started to release that series on YouTube or wherever it is, I called almost everybody that was involved in that I had their phone numbers and told them how good it was and how much I liked it, because I just thought it was great. And this is in those, and to me, it's in that same ballpark. It's not like Southpaw, but I mean, it's just like that. It's good shit. It's funny. It ain't your hardcore stuff that's going to, you know, headline WrestleMania, but fuck, it's entertaining. And I'll give both those guys a shout out of respect.
And it's well done for what they're doing. They're self-aware and executing it well. And there's an attention to detail, like just that the bulletin board. I just want to pause it and zoom in and see all the little inside jokes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Anything else jump out before we ride off in the sunset? And I want you to plug your show.
Yeah, we actually did the first show dropped Tuesday this week.
Oh, super.
An hour 40 minutes with Jason Powell from ProWrestling.net as my co-host. And we broke down Raw. We talked to a correspondent who was in the building in Nashville and got that in-person perspective. And we answered a bunch of email questions, and we had a lot to talk about. Obviously, a lot of focus on Jason Jordan and then the angle with Braun at the end. But we covered everything. So that is available right now. And then the SmackDown show also available with Travis Bryant as my co-host. We talked to somebody in the building was it Birmingham?
No, Birmingham, I'm forgetting. Alabama.
Yeah, in Alabama. And we did another hour and a half plus and did a talked about the eight topics and then answered a bunch of email questions. So the flagship show drops the same day as this, Steve. So Thursday, I'm going to have Bruce Mitchell on, and we're going to go in depth on a broad array of topics. And then Friday, tomorrow, my first interview is with Jack Swagger and John Piermarini. And John Piermarini was a writer, creative team member during Jack Swagger's rise. And it's a cool conversation between two people who play very different roles but hit it off and had creative chemistry. And they talked about that chemistry and the dynamic behind the scenes of a writer and a wrestler and how that evolves and some of the trials and tribulations of that. And it's a fascinating interview. So I hope everybody finds Wade Keller's Pro Wrestling Podcast, the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, on Podcast One, or just do a search for Wade Keller in iTunes and subscribe. We're on 4 days a week every week starting this week.
Okay, if I listen to the interview, will I find out what Jack Swagger is doing here and now?
He's launching a clothing company with his wife, and we did not spend time talking about his indie matches, but he's semi-active out there in the indie scene. I want to do a second part with him, but I haven't talked to him about it, where we just talk about him. This was actually a really focused interview on just the kind of the writer-wrestler dynamic.
And where is he living now?
You know what? I don't know.
God damn it. You interviewed the guy and you don't know where he's living. Wade, God damn it.
We had limited time and I wish we had more time. I would have gotten into all that. I'm sorry to let you down, Steve.
Hey, man, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. I got something to say. Any of you yeah. motherfuckers listening to this podcast, I got my headset on. The same son of a bitch as Wade Keller's got on. And if I get one complaint about Steve, could you stop the breathing so loud while Wade's talking? Hey, I had the microphone bent as far to the left as I could and half the interview. I was holding my fucking breath. So if anybody's pissed off about my breathing, which I do in order to stay alive, fuck off. How's that, Wade?
I kind of knew before he went on the air this is going to be a fun show. It has been.
Man, gotta breathe, goddammit. I gotta get my deviated septums fixed. Until that time, I'm going to sound like Darth Vader over here. And that's the bottom line, because I said so. Wade, it's always good talking to you. Stay on the line. I'm going to say goodbye to the people, and I got one other thing to drive by you. Wade Keller, everybody, he's on Podcast One now, along with his other stuff. Check him out. Find his show. Subscribe. Hit the download button.
PWTorch.com. PWTorch.com. Read my Raw reports and pay-per-view reports and SmackDown reports there, too.
Thank you, Wade. We're out.
Yep. Thanks, Steve.